Is it time to tweak sanctions against Iran? And why is Iran about to shut off the internet? From APM, I'm Jeff Horwich. This is the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. It is September 24th. Happy Monday. Happy New Week to you. We're also going to talk to Alan Sloan about which recent president has enjoyed the best stock market performance. And we'll hear about the latest tricks of the trade in the beverage industry. First, though, Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is in New York this week. He'll speak to the UN General Assembly. That is always an event. But he's not invited to another key meeting where world leaders will discuss what's next for oil sanctions against Iran. So far, it's been a partial boycott of Iranian crude, but it's been tough to know whether that has caused enough economic pain. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Scott Tong.
The sanctions include an import ban by the Europeans and American threats against insurance companies, banks, and tankers that connect Tehran to its customers. It has thrown sand in the gears. Iran today sells about 1 million barrels a day, half what it was last year. Still, Robert McNally at the Rapidan Group says Tehran is now pumping less oil, cutting world supply.
They're raising oil prices for everybody, but the pain they're feeling is not yet enough to get them anywhere close to conceding with regard to their nuclear programs.
So now, drivers around the world are hurting too. Who will blink first? Certainly the Iranian people are suffering. The currency has fallen by half and inflation is rampant. Consultant Robin Mills in Dubai says that doesn't mean the Iranian leaders will admit it.
That might lead them to calculate that, hey, we have to show we're tough, because if we come to the negotiating table now, then the West will think the sanctions are in effect and they'll just tighten them more and more.
Mills thinks Tehran will wait out the U.S. election, so it knows exactly who it's dealing with. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
More interesting news out of Iran today. Over the weekend, the government there announced it was turning off Google. Officials also said plans are moving ahead to place the country's web users into a walled-off intranet, as opposed to the global internet the rest of us use. Daryl West is the Director of Governance Studies and the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. Good to talk with you.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
It seems like there are two general explanations in play here. First, censorship. Second, the Iranian government wants to wall the country off to some extent against cyber attacks. Which of those do you think is the predominant factor?
I think the Iranians are mostly worried about cybersecurity at this point. In 2010, there was a computer worm which basically attacked their centrifuges as part of its uranium enrichment facility. And so the government has been very worried that outside organizations can disable its infrastructure. And so their response is to develop this domestic internet so that they can better protect their national resources.
Certainly, censorship would seem to be a nice side benefit, as it were.
Censorship is a great side benefit. Of course, the Iranian leaders are very upset about street protests. And with the recent anti-Islamic film, the government feels the need to be able to shut down things and censor information when it chooses to do so.
Do you think Iran can really cut its people off effectively from the internet, or cut itself off from cyber attacks?
I don't think it's going to effectively cut itself off or even want to cut itself off, because the world is so globalized. And even though Iran has difficult relations with the United States, creating your own internet really doesn't make a lot of sense because there are intra-country communications, but there also are now a lot of cross-border communications.
Daryl West, Director of Governance Studies and the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution. Thanks.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. Markets were down across the world today in Asia and Europe, and now here in the U.S. as well. At this hour, a couple hours into trading, the Dow Industrials are down 0.2%, the S&P 500 down 0.3%, and the NASDAQ down a little more, about 0.7%. Oil prices are also falling today. Lately, we've charted the struggles of luxury companies like Tiffany and Burberry. Not so at Prada, evidently. Prada profits were up 60% in the first half of the year. What else we got? Apple tells us they have sold more than 5 million iPhone 5s in the first 3 days since Friday's launch. That is, that's a lot of iPhones. And Discover Card users may have a little extra cash back coming. Learned this morning the federal government has ordered Discover to refund $200 million to customers. They say Discover used misleading marketing to get people to pay for add-on products like identity theft protection and credit score tracking. A federal court in Australia has found Lehman Brothers liable for damages in a class action suit. It's the first case of its kind against the defunct U.S. investment firm, and it could open the door to more lawsuits around the world. From Sydney, here's Stuart Cohen.
72 city councils, church groups, and other nonprofits were part of the suit against Lehman's Australian arm. The groups bought around $250 million worth of the now infamous securities that were backed by subprime mortgages in the U.S. Lehman told the groups the investments were AAA rated, but the court said Lehman's advice was misleading. John Walker is with IMF Australia, the company that funded the lawsuit.
What we dealt with is to see whether or not we'd make accountable an investment bank that actually sought to target not-for-profit organizations and make profit from selling derivatives to them.
This was the first lawsuit to look at the conduct of an investment bank on both legal and ethical grounds in the lead-up to the global financial crisis. Others around the world will now be encouraged with their attempts to recover money from what's left of Lehman Brothers. The Australian nonprofits still have another case pending against Standard & Poor's, the ratings agency that gave those securities their AAA rating. In Sydney, I'm Stuart Cohen for Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
We've said it before, and we'll say it again now. The economy and the stock market are not one and the same. The performance of the economy under a president is open to wide interpretation. The performance of the stock market, on the other hand, well, that's also hard to explain, but at least it is pretty straightforward to measure. And what do we find when we do? Alan Sloan got curious. He is Fortune Magazine's senior editor-at-large, and he joins me every couple weeks for a chat. Hello, Alan.
Good morning, Jeff.
So let's start with the conventional wisdom here that stock market returns, our investments, might fare better under a Republican president. How does that logic go?
Well, the logic goes, and it makes sense as logic, that Republicans are more pro-business, they're into lower taxes, so therefore Republicans will have more investor-friendly programs, and therefore investors will invariably do better under Republican presidents than under Democratic presidents.
So you asked the folks at Wilshire Associates to track this for you. For every president since 1980, and for data reasons, they had to start in 1980. What did they find?
Well, they found, much to their surprise and somewhat to my surprise, that even Ronald Reagan, who cut taxes and during whose administration the stock market really took off, actually underperformed the two Democrats in the sample.
And we had George W. Bush in the sample as well. How about his presidency?
Well, it was disastrous for pretty much everybody, I think. He lowered taxes on investments to the lowest point in modern history. And over a total of 8 years, you lost 25% of your money, which is an extraordinarily bad record for 8 years.
And now for the big finale. Which president in this modern sample had the best overall return?
Amazingly, it's of all people, Obama, which definitely surprised me. The last time I looked, there was a total return, which is capital gains and reinvested dividends. Since Obama took office, that have about doubled your money. The previous best term was Clinton's first term at 92%. So who'd have thunk it? I guess for statistical purposes, it helps to come in when there's a financial panic and the market's been driven down.
Of course, that's an essential effect here. What a lucky duck that President Obama inheriting that horrible economy. Alan Sloan, Fortune Magazine's senior editor at large. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jeff.
So here's a familiar scenario. You're thirsty. That happens a few times a day, at least, I suppose. You walk into the store maybe to buy something to drink, but you're not sure exactly what you want. You are inundated with choices. Well, the choice you eventually make will likely have more to do with what the package looks like than what liquid is actually inside of it. That might sound a little crazy, but that is what the beverage industry thinks you'll do. Earlier today, my colleague Jeremy Hobson talked with Gary Hemphill. Gary is with the Beverage Marketing Corporation. Here's Jeremy with more.
So how important is packaging when consumers go in and try to decide which beverage to buy?
Well, I'll say this. It's more important today than it was yesterday or 10, 20 years ago. And that's because there's so many more products on the market.
So when you go into the convenience store and you see hundreds of different colored bottles and different sizes and shapes, these companies really have to make their products stand out.
That's right. A lot of times people are thirsty. They go into the store not exactly knowing what it is they're going to purchase. They just know they want a beverage. And so the package design, the package colors is really a last chance to sell the product to the consumer.
So who's doing a great job at marketing their product by using the bottle?
I would mention specifically Arizona as a brand, because if you think about it in terms of marketing dollars spent, advertising or billboards or, you know, TV, radio spots, they do nothing. What they do is they put all their effort in their packaging, in their packaging design and style. And that's really how that brand developed over time. So I'd have to give them an A-plus from a packaging standpoint.
Now, of course, Arizona tastes different from Gatorade or Coke or whatever. But then there's this whole market of bottled water, and it's all water. So how do they differentiate?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think water is a unique category, because if you look at just plain water, there's a lot of decisions that consumers are making, and some of them have to do specifically with packaging. Consumers may want a specific package size. They may want a specific closure or cap. Some people love the sports cap. Some people just refuse to use the sports cap. Mm. So it goes beyond the graphics, and consumers have very specific preferences that they go in wanting when they buy that product.
What else are companies doing to try to get me or you or anybody to go out and buy their beverage in the store?
Well, really, beyond packaging, it comes down to the products themselves.
Oh, you mean the stuff that's inside? That matters?
Shockingly enough, people buy products for reasons other than just the package. I think we're entering a bit of an era of specialization, where sort of the one-size-fits-all beverage is kind of yesterday's product, and the product of today is really very much more specific. And that's why you see all these products in the marketplace. You see energy drinks, you see sports drinks, you see bottle and can teas. And the challenge then is, you know, how many of these products can actually fit on a shelf in the store? Because the store shelves aren't really getting all that much bigger.
Gary Hemphill is Managing Director of Research at the Beverage Marketing Corporation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
And finally, the new economic data that we have for you this morning actually has to do with economists. The National Association for Business Economics has put out its new policy survey, and there are some interesting tidbits in there. Most economists, for example, are happy with current Federal Reserve policy. They would rather the government focus on stimulus for the time being and save the real deficit cutting for a year or two down the road. And when it comes to cutting the deficit, this is interesting to me, a vast majority recommend tax hikes and spending cuts, so-called balanced approach. A plurality, about 45%, as I recall from looking at the survey, said that tax hikes and spending cuts should be about equal in balancing the deficit. Is anybody actually listening to economists? Should they even? Is a good question. Both those questions, unfortunately, were not on the survey. And finally, in a messed up economy like Zimbabwe, the phrase giant flushing sound might have any number of metaphorical applications, but in this case, it is quite literal. Over the weekend, officials in the second largest city in Zimbabwe, Bulawayo, asked all 1 million residents to flush their toilets simultaneously at an appointed time, 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, as I recall. You see, the city's decrepit sewer system gets clogged up, especially during a drought like they are having at the moment. And sometimes, evidently, one big community flush can get things moving again. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update. Not that we're going down the drain, but I will end on that note. I'm Jeff Horwich, and we're coming to you from APM, American Public Media.